Ukraine has not understood that you can win a war even if you go backwards. It's not about territory. The aim is to destroy the forces. And that's exactly the doctrine of the Russians. And by using maneuver warfare, that's exactly, for instance, what the Russians have done in Kherson in October 2022 and in Kharkov in September 2022. When the Ukrainians counterattacked there, the Russians could anticipate that movement, and they withdrew even before being in contact with the Ukrainians. So the Ukrainians came into an empty area. They were bombed by the Russian artillery. The Russians could withdraw in good order without having contact with the enemy. And that's exactly the way you win this kind of war. But the Russians have been expert in this kind of things. When the enemy is too strong for in front of you, instead of trying to struggle against an enemy which is superior in force, you just withdraw, you leave an empty space. The Ukrainian enter the space, you destroy them with artillery, aircraft, flying bombs, and whatever, and then you save the life of your own troops. And that's, if you look carefully at what has happening since 2023, I mean, in fact, October 2022, if we are serious, we look at all that, the Russians have been consistently doing that, thus killing Ukrainians for nothing, basically.
Yeah. So what do you make about the second part of his claim there, which I found surprising, that he actually said, yeah, we don't have a shortage of weapons and ammunition anymore. We can still use some air defense missiles, but we're pretty good on the rest. Do you think that's accurate? And if not,
no, I think it's not. I think he's lying. But to understand that, we have to understand that Zelensky is sitting between two chairs. On the one hand, he has to portray the Russian as weak as possible in order not to discourage the support of the Europeans. And at the same time, he has to show that the Russians are still a threat to Europe, not simply to Ukraine, but also to Europe, because so that motivates the Europeans. Because in here in Europe, it's very interesting. A lot of people are scared about the possible Russian invasion. I mean, I know a lot of people who tell me, well, I'm scared about Putin because he may attack us. Where do they take that from? I mean, obviously from the media. But, you know, there is no objective information that can confirm the idea that A, the Russians want to attack Europe, B, that they have the enough resources to attack Europe, and C, that what the objective they want to achieve. What for? You know, the Europeans, I mean, the Westerners at large, have been used to wage war without an objective. Yes, right. But that's right. The reality.
No, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of it like that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly that. I mean, that's exactly why we lose our wars, because we don't know what we want to achieve. I mean, I know several officers that I knew in the NATO, and some of them ended in, they have not ended, but they were engaged in Barkhane, the Operation Barkhane in the North Africa, in Mali and Niger against terrorists. And when they came back, I had the opportunity to talk and to have some kind of, not a debriefing, but let's say, a discussion about what they experience. But I said, well, the main problem we have is that we don't know what we want to achieve. They kill people, and they are very effective in killing people, but they don't solve the problem. Because, and all of them told me, when we are engaged in Mali or Niger, we kill one, you have 10 more that come up. Meaning that
the exact same experience in Afghanistan and Iraq. I observed it myself.
This is exactly that. You know, when I was in Afghanistan, people told me exactly the same thing. There is no objective. They don't know what they want to achieve. And we are used to that. We go in places and it's easy because we have superior firepower. So it's very easy to go and just fire around and that's it. But what are you achieving? You are not solving the problem. You are not, and you mentioned Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, what happened? The government that the U.S. put in place lost how many? 48 hours before being changed. So, you know, even the Russians, when they left in 1989, they managed to, they put in place a government, and this government lasts for 2 years. The Americans, when they left Afghanistan, the government they had put in place lasts just 48 hours.
Right.
So, yeah, but that means that the Russians knew exactly why they were fighting for, and the whole the purpose of their presence. And they used the time. I mean, obviously, I was in intelligence at that time. I received all the report every day, and I was in touch with Ahmed Shah Massoud in the Afghan resistance. So I have followed this conflict very closely. But we noticed that the Russians, besides what happened in the valleys and all that, all the battles and things like this, besides this, you had a political work that was being done in Kabul, and administration was put in place, and political, you had a whole setting. A state was functioning there, probably not the way you would prefer in Switzerland or in the United States, but that was a functioning government. And when they left, they just withdrew, and they went back to the Soviet Union. By the way, when they went, it was done in a very festive way. I mean, you had parade and all that. It was not just a withdrawal with people trying to grip the airplanes and all that. That was not like this. They went in good order. All the tanks, flags were in the air and all that. So yeah, they even made a medal for those who left Afghanistan on that day. So this was done in a very orderly way. And the government remained in place for 2 years. What happened in Afghanistan after the Westerners left, 2 days, and everything was lost. And all the equipment today is parading on Bagram Air Base. It's manned by the Taliban, you know. So meaning that the problem is that we are used in the West to fight wars without objectives.
And therefore, you know, I'm sorry, I'm running a little bit short on time here. I don't want to miss this one here, because there's another, I think, really negative proclivity on the Western side, and that is to overestimate what we can get done and underestimate what Russia can do on the other side. And one other thing that Zelensky mentioned here today was that he actually, I'm not making this up, you'll see it now, he equated pressuring Putin with success the same way Trump pressured Hamas for success.
Russia's war in Europe remains the biggest source of global instability, and it depends on all of you whether this war will end too. Putin can be forced into peace, just like any other terrorist. Even Hamas is now preparing to release hostages. If that is possible, then Putin can also be forced to restore peace.
So stands to reason, if Hamas can be forced into giving up hostages, then Vladimir Putin can be forced to giving up stuff to Ukraine. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, he had the opportunity to talk to the Russians, because he talked to them in March 2022. And he was the one who broke the talks. So he's a perfect idiot. In fact, there were three occasions in which Zelensky himself asked to have a dialogue with Russians. That was on the 25th of February 2022, 1 day after the beginning of the special military operation. Zelensky called the Swiss foreign minister and asked to organize a peace conference. That started the process in Gomel. The conference never happened, but you had talks in Gomel at the Belarus border. That was on the request of Ukraine. But eventually what happened? Those negotiators, those who negotiated on the Ukrainian side, were killed by the SBU. And even agent of the military intelligence, the GUR, were killed by agent of the SBU, the security service, because they were negotiating with the Russians. And this is not my invention. That was said by, but you can read my book. It's written in my book on covert wars in Ukraine. And that was said by Kirill Budanov. He said that in the media, in the Ukrainian media.
Really?
That was said, and he explained very clearly that Kireyev, I may be wrong with the name, but I think the negotiator was Kireyev. He was an agent of the GUR. He was assassinated by the SBU. And the first negotiation round stopped in January. Now, 3 weeks later, Zelensky came back with the talks in Ukraine. That was already also at the request of Ukraine, and that happened. And you know that it was short-circuited by Boris Johnson, the Europeans. I mean, okay, we have discussed that already.
Yeah.
And then you had a third occasion, and that was when Erdogan visited Zelensky in Lviv, I think, in August 2022. And on that occasion, Erdogan proposed a summit between Zelensky and Putin. And Zelensky, in fact, agreed to the summit. Putin was not immediately enthusiastic about it, but eventually the same day, that was the 18th of August 2022, Putin accepted to have a meeting with Zelensky. And once again, Boris Johnson came and said, no flimsy agreement with the Russians, and the whole thing stopped. And then happened what I said before. This was the stop about any negotiation with the Russians. But Zelensky had three opportunities to talk to the Russians. Why did he stop that? Why didn't he say to the Europeans, I want to talk to the Russians? Because in fact, he traded peace and peace talks against money. And that's exactly what he's asking for today, money. That's exactly what drives Zelensky, is money. And that's why I think this is something extremely disturbing to hear what he says, because he had the opportunity, he missed he renounced the opportunity deliberately, and today he's crying for that. I mean, this is just insane. And and in addition to that, I think he's exaggerated the potential of his ability now. For just open a parenthesis about the comparison with Hamas. Hamas started its operation the 7th of October to protect, in fact, the population, because the whole issue was the dialogue that was broken by Israeli government about the prisoners, because you had prisoners and you had talks in 2022, and the Netanyahu government stopped brutally this discussion. And it's in order to resume the discussion that Hamas made this attack in order to take, you can call them hostages. I think I took them prisoners of war, because they were all people who were occupying force for Gaza. The Gaza division is essentially, by international law, a force that is in charge of occupying Gaza. I mean, even if it's from the outside, it's still legally an occupation. And what the Hamas did was to take some people to resume the negotiation about the prisoners. So the Hamas started the whole attack and the whole process, in fact, in order to negotiate about its own Palestinians, about the population, the Palestinian population. Now, it's exactly the same reason for the Russians to attack Ukraine. The Russians attacked Ukraine when the Ukrainians started to attack the Donbas population. And that's what prompted this preemptive attack, we can say, even if it was not exactly preemptive, because the Ukrainians had already started to attack the Donbass population. And this is confirmed by OSCE observers, This has been documented quite widely. So you can compare the two. Of course, the name terrorist is a little bit scary, but note that only Western countries consider Hamas as a terrorist, and the UN does not consider the Hamas as terrorist. Consider that. But beyond this, the motivation and the rationale for the Hamas on one hand and for the Russians on the other hand is very similar, because they feel their action as existential. Now, the Israelis and the Ukrainians are in the same situation. They were the ones who tried to oppress a population on both sides. I mean, legally, everything that Israel is doing to the Gaza population and was doing prior to the 7th of October was basically an oppression, because they have absolutely no reason to do that. Gaza should not be an occupied territory. It should be, as the UN and the International Court of Justice has ruled, it is a Palestinian territory, and where the Palestinians should have an independent, a sovereign authority, period. And Israel doesn't want this. And this is exactly what the Ukrainians on their side were doing to the Donbas population. So there is a lot of similarities in the two, if we compare that way. But we don't want to go into many details, because obviously these are not the same conflicts.
Right, right, right. And then it also breaks down with the power of the Hamas or the Russian side. Then it gets way
well. That's the difference, exactly, and that's right. And that's where the distinction is very important, because Russia has obviously a capacity of leverage over the Ukrainians, what Hamas has not really. The difference is probably made by what happened worldwide, this support, not to the Hamas, but the support to the Palestinians and to what the Palestinians have endured for all these years, and what has become more apparent through the 7th of October, which, by the way, was probably also an objective to raise the issue of the Palestinian issue to expose that to the world. And that was definitely achieved. But we cannot compare one-to-one those conflicts. They are not exactly the same, and there are a lot of differences and all that. But the situation is very similar to some extent. And when Zelensky said that you can pressure Russia, this is discounting the fact that Russia is more powerful than Ukraine, and is probably even more powerful than the whole of Europe.
Right, right. And that does make the difference. Listen, I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave it there for right now. It's fascinating idea, though, about at least the similarities between the Hamas side and Israel and the Russian side and the Ukrainians. We're going to go into that in more detail next time you get on. I think that's a fascinating idea. But thank you very much for bringing up all these issues today and just laying it out there the way it really is and about the hard power politics. Thank you so much for coming on.
No problem. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't. And by the way, speaking of the Middle East, we are going to talk about that this afternoon at 2:30 p.m. Joy in the Middle East. We're at least for this time, we're going to look at the happiness on both sides about getting their prisoners and hostages back. We'll take a look at some other things as well, but at least this one day, there is something to be happy about in the Middle East. We'll see you this afternoon at 2:30 p.m. on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.